Horticulture.com, the Limitless, the podcast between. This is Jason Horsey one more time, this time again for the third time, talking to Holly Grigg Spall. How are you?
I'm good. I'm okay, I think. How are you?
Okay, surrounded by liminality and insanity.
Yes, but nothing's changed there, so that's okay. I think I've got used to it now.
I guess you're not ever supposed to be able to get used to liminality, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if you get. Yeah, I think it's not so much. It's weird how I think, though, I think you talk about it and people talk about it and, you know, you have certain concepts of what that is, and it's usually quite high concepts of what it is, like these people doing these things that you can't even imagine, and like they're you know, that it's all very distant, you know, and all very dramatic and all very kind of theatrical. But then when you live here and you're on like the very fringes of that whole world that people associate with Illuminati, you sort of get to see the mundane side of it in a way.
Oh, you heard me say Illuminati. I said liminality.
Oh, yeah. Weird. Yeah. Oh, I thought you said Illuminati.
Well, so we jump right in.
Oh, you said that. Oh, I see. No, never get used to that. No, very uncomfortable situation. That's a completely different thing, but there you go.
Yeah, but anyway, seeing as you did go on that tack, and because I never talk about the Illuminati, I mean, I might have been joking there, because I might joke about it. I don't talk about it seriously because not that I think it's all a lot of nonsense, as you know, but just because it's all been grouped together under this kind of one narrative, and it reduces it to something very facile. But anyway, so you were referring to living in Hollywood specifically.
Yeah, see, that's what I thought you were joking about. And I picked up that you were joking, but I thought you were sort of, because we always say, oh, we'll talk about living in Hollywood, and we never get to it. So
right,
I thought you were joking about that.
But
I feel like in the last year especially, and I was talking to my husband about this, it's almost been like this experience of being on the edges, and the edges are quite mundane and sort of, you don't really almost realize you're on those edges until you're out of the situation, right? Mm. And then you're like, well, if I'd said yes and yes and yes instead of going no, 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 maybe I would have been further into that, and where would that have taken me? But then you start seeing sort of the edges of it, and you're like, oh, that's interesting. Okay, so some people do say yes, and where do they go next after they say yes?
Yeah, well, you've absolutely zeroed in on something that has preoccupied me for a long time, and you've also zeroed in on the, quite brilliantly, I might add, the equivalence between liminality and Illuminati, because you're talking about the threshold, right?
Yeah, that's true, and about saying yes, 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 or no, or a combination of both, and how saying, well, yes and no, leaves you in that state, right, where you feel, in some cases, you can think of an even recent example where I was thinking that, well, my answer to that question is yes and no, so where does that put me?
Yeah. Can you be more specific, or are you not able to be?
Well, I can. This is not in the context of the Illuminati, so I can go
as
into
far
that,
as you know.
As far as I know, exactly. I can go into that too, though, because that has been quite interesting. I was going to talk about this anyway, because it really focused me on what we were talking about last time about getting back to the body and kind of occupying the body and being in the body. And I got into this sort of, I hate to say online altercation, it always makes it sound so, well, it's almost like you can just feel yourself feeling like, oh God, how pointless. But it was about in the aftermath of the Women's March, which is not something I took part in. You're probably the only person I've told that to.
Yeah.
So I've had
and
to.
Now the world knows.
Now the world knows I didn't go. Yeah. Again, that was me having to sort of live in that space where I wasn't saying I did go, but I wasn't saying I didn't go.
Right.
And there was this interesting thing, phenomenon to me, watching, you know, the coverage of it online, that a lot of women were carrying signs and holding signs that had representations of, like, the uterus and the ovaries and the vagina and, like, female biology on them. And I found that really interesting. And I wondered, like, what was in that, like, what could be taken from that, where would that go if it was people continued to see, to think about things in that way, especially in a collective situation. And there was this almost immediate backlash from some groups that were saying that, you know, that women shouldn't have done that because it was associating those reproductive organs with womanhood.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can't do that anymore because there are women who have penises.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found that quite sort of dazzling almost to begin with. And I was lulled into this sort of, oh, well, that's, I like that. I like the fact that women are doing that. And then sort of aggressively taken out of that little comfort area there where I was thinking, oh, that's a good thing. And then it was like, well, no, it's not a good thing, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conversation that ensued after that meant that I realized I just occupied this liminal space in that discussion where I, you know, there were some people who were saying, well, you know, having these reproductive organs doesn't have any bearing on who you are, but it does mean that you're female. And then there were people who were saying, well, having those reproductive organs doesn't have any bearing on who you are, but it means that you could be female or male. It's up to you. You get to decide. And I realized I felt like I occupied this space where I was like, well, actually, no, I sort of do think having those reproductive organs just does have a bearing on who you are.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe how you behave and maybe decisions that you make and your actions and maybe even how you think. But at the same time, I think that doesn't mean that everybody who has them behaves in exactly the same way. And that it's not like a precursor, but it can be something that is, you know, it has a part, right? It plays a part. So yeah, I found myself sort of between these two camps where I was being, very much criticized from one side and then being ushered into this other camp only to find myself going, do you all agree with me here or not? Oh no, probably not as well, but I'm just going to have to be okay with that because you seem to be less aggressive about how much you disagree than these other people. Yeah, and then you start thinking, well, is that a compulsion that I have to not agree?
Mm-hmm.
With the group that I'm in,
wow.
And been accepted into. So I went down a bit of a bit personal hole of like trying to figure out what that was all about.
Yeah, there's a lot. There's an awful lot there. I'm just trying to get my head around the whole situation that you're describing. It is very much, I think, what I was referring to when I asked how you were holding up. With all the liminality, it just being more intensified in the US and perhaps even more so where you are in that particular corner of California. The polarization, for one thing, the grouping that's going on. You see, there's a couple of things in what you said that I was having difficulty relating to. One was this whole idea, and I think you may agree, of what has bearing on who I am. Like, like, well, wait a minute, you know, how do I even relate to that, like that
yes.
question is such an odd one, right?
Yeah.
But without getting stuck on that, we may come back to the other one. And then the other one is about groups and finding oneself in a group and saying the right thing and saying the wrong thing. I have that experience online. I'm aware of it as a phenomenon, but I don't really have it as on a daily basis the way you're describing, and I presume that's partly because definitely where you live, as we've already touched on, but also partly because you're involved in a kind of personal activity which is socially charged. Well, I'm trying to think, because what I do is socially relevant, it's socially charged, but it's, I don't know. But what you're doing seems to be very specifically attracting the attention of these groups, or these the kinds of people who tend to group together, if you know what I mean by this, ideologically.
Oh, ideologically, yeah, I do know what you mean by that, for sure. Yeah, I think it's... Although I think people can... I think people can project maybe more onto the things that I'm doing because it's even more... or can maybe misunderstand it. I don't know, maybe just because it's more publicly spoken about or a bit more of a hot topic kind of thing. But yeah, it's never gone away. This isn't really anything new, but I feel like it's definitely intensified to the point that, you know, talking about groups and the post that you wrote, the last blog post that you wrote, Balkan, about Balkanization and dividing and people being suspicious of each other. I mean, I've found myself like, first of all, feeling very much like, well, I think we talked, the last time we talked was just prior to the election day, which is interesting. I feel like I was in a really different headspace then. I feel like I had been sort of, I felt almost a little bit controlled by it in a way. And now I'm managing to break free again. By actually like really engaging with it to the point of going, okay, this is what happened to you. You got sucked into it. Got sucked into it, and that happened. And I don't want that to happen again.
So in terms of censoring what you were saying, for example.
Yeah, and also being sort of unnecessarily defensive, I think, because I felt like I was defending some bigger issue than, and not really relating to what I felt about it. Because it had become like I wasn't just me and my experience, I was like part of this bigger problem, right? And I think purposefully, if you'd ask, you know, if I was going to be honest about it, that was all that whole cycle with the way that, you know, women were supposed to respond to Hillary and how we were supposed to respond to Trump and the way that that went, I think that it was very manipulative, and I feel like it was, you know, it felt very, like being controlled, I think. And it was hard to avoid somehow. It was like a quicksand. Like you just kind of, you know, you thought you were on top of it. You thought you were on solid ground, and then you're like, oh no, I got pulled under. I got pulled under by it, and then you think, well, how do I climb my way out? And I think in doing that, you know, I've felt like in the last, that your post really resonated with me, because I felt very much like in the last few, what is it now, couple of months, this sort of divide and being driven kind of slightly mad, not by what everybody else thinks they're being driven mad by, which is, you know, Trump doing what Trump does, but by the response to it. And, you know, part of that for me has been, in recent weeks, actually, partly as a result of what I was explaining just now, just actually losing friends over it, which has been a really disturbing experience.
You mean like long-term friends?
Yeah. Not necessarily people that I, you know, actually in one case, someone that I speak to quite frequently, but in another case, it was somebody who, you know, I knew when I used to live in London and hadn't really been in touch with me for years. And then this particular issue of the Women's March and whether women should be talking about their bodies in that context, in that way, or acknowledging them, really pressed a button and was just like, okay, you are one of those people now. So
she saw that.
Yes. And so now I cannot be associated with you. And I'm feeling on the precipice of that with a few other people as well. Not quite there yet, but definitely getting there.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have do you have a personal sort of visceral response to Trump?
Not anymore. I think, as I say, that was part for me of getting, I think it was after the tapes were released, the whole pussy grabbing thing. up to the point of the election, I sort of got fell down this slope and just went into this quicksand. And I felt like it was being, my buttons were being pushed purposefully. Now I look back. And so now, no, I just now, I think on I think from election night onwards, it was interesting because it was like being traumatized, purposefully traumatized in a weird way, where, you know, I was pushed into to defending, even to defending Hillary, you know, to defending her or talking about feminism in this very academic way. And then everybody freaking out about it, right? And coming out of that and knowing that I wasn't comfortable with spending what the next 4 years freaking out. I wasn't going to do that. I wasn't going to be freaking out. I wasn't going to do what people seem to be quite literally saying, like, I want to freak out. We should be freaking out. This is scary. This is frightening. Here's a suicide hotline. This is the worst thing ever. And I had to sort of go, hang on. No, it's not. That's not. That's. I had a day where I was like discombobulated. It's probably the best word for it. Where I felt like almost like I'd been, like I was a, like a un unmoored or like a boat that was tipped over. And I had to sort of go, okay, bring myself back up again above the surface. And then, you know, realign how I felt and get back into who I am, where I am, and, you know, my own space and sort of, yeah, it felt like a very weird experience, but watching everybody else just sort of happily, almost, happily freak out, and happily signal their feeling of absolute kind of terror and helplessness, and be persuaded and like encouraged to feel that way.
So when you say everybody else, are you talking about women or men also?
I think women, and especially in where I am here, men too. I think women more vocally, perhaps, but I know that with some of the men I spoke to too, it was like, well, they were either sort of kind of like a bit wryly humorous about it, like, oh, well, just trying to shirk it off, but clearly uncomfortable talking about it. But then with women, it's more, this came across to me as more this sort of sense of this is the legitimate response. Anybody else who isn't responding like this, who is in a threatened group, that in quotations is not responding appropriately.
You have to panic.
Yes, yeah, like a panic is a
Main thing is to panic.
yeah, like that was that. If you weren't panicking, then you were flagged as something wrong there. What was going on there? Did you vote for him, or you know,
Not
like,
taking it seriously enough, basically.
yes, which is funny because I think to me it's like, well, no, I feel like I'm taking it more seriously. So I don't know.
Well, I heard from somebody a while back who was a survivor of organized abuse, even ritual abuse, and it was she said something about Trump, and for the first time I paused and thought, okay, well, maybe there is something here to Trump that I haven't been able to see. And what it was that she said that there was something about him that triggered her, because she felt that it was because he reminded her of the kind of man that she had been abused by, that there was just something visceral about Trump or her reaction to Trump, that related to an energy of male abuse that she had actually experienced. And I just wondered then, like, okay, so maybe there's something in here that is deliberate and significant, that Trump, whatever he represents, that is terrifying people so much, but particularly women, that there is something real there. I mean, completely outside of him just being a figurehead and a puppet dictator and this, that and the other, you know, a method actor and all the rest of it, and the irrelevance of him in terms of the policies that he might be pushing, or the way that the so-called left or Democratic Party have framed him, and all that stuff that we know is largely astroturfing and all the rest of it. Maybe there's something about Trump and why he was chosen that really was intended to trigger people at the, you know, the deepest part of their brain stem and provoke these kind of reactions.
Yeah, and it was hard, though, I think, even when you were in it, for me at least, to know what was that was a response to him and what was a response that was being triggered by the response to him. You see what I'm saying? So,
yeah,
like, however people actually felt in their homes, sat on the sofa watching the television, like, we were told this is how people in general, women in general, felt, right? So it became almost impossible to divide the two. Like, did I feel that way about him? Did I feel that way because I was being told I was supposed to feel that way about him?
Yeah, being swept along by the social contagion.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was what I was going to ask you, was exactly that. Like, if you could tell where one ended and one began.
Well, I think when I knew when I was in it, this is when I say in it, I mean sort of pre-election day, that he was not, I don't see him as a fearful figure, like, in comparison to even to his vice president, who sort of maybe gave me that energy more in a way. Mm. And it's also, I mean, this guy's been in the sort of social consciousness for a long time in different ways. You know, he's been popped up through history in different ways, the recent history as different characters. So if that was true, I feel like that would have been something that was manufactured pretty recently, because I don't feel like when he was on The Apprentice, for example, people felt like that about him.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
Mm.
But no, I really felt more the day after the election, sort of discombobulated, and I felt like the following day that I was thinking, well, this is an interesting time. It's a liminal time, right, in itself, that, you know, he's not president yet, but he's going to be, and we were told that over and over again, like, so many days until he's actually president.
Yeah.
And then, but also it was like this feeling sort of traumatized more by the manipulation of it. You know, I always sort of felt him winning was an inevitability, so that wasn't necessarily surprising to me. And I think if I'd kept grounded in that instinct and knowledge and knowing, then I wouldn't have felt so weird afterwards. But I didn't. I let it go. And I let the sort of idea of what the opposition was, how they were drawing people into this support for the opposition, that I let that kind of override what my early instinct was. And I think I would have been able to just go with that. And I knew, I kind of just felt like I knew. But then at the same time afterwards, I was like, well, if I could be as someone who, like, not arrogantly, but sees myself as able to sort of read above things slightly, was purely through engaging with the media coverage of it, able to be so manipulated, that was like, well, okay, this is an interesting space we're in now, because you could really tell anybody anything and they'd grasp onto it, right? Mm. Because you're so, feel so vulnerable and kind of raw. And I got that feeling from a lot of other people, and they stayed in that for weeks.
Mm.
You know, weeks and weeks, they were like close to tears, which is sort of baffling to me.
Yeah.
But also I could see it as like, well, okay, well, why is that? Like, where did that come from? What use does that have? What came next? I was there beneath a monument.
So another obvious difference between your situation and mine is that you're, and I kind of said it in a different way, I suppose, that what you're involved in includes having to be tapped into the mainstream media a lot more. Like, I don't really tune into it at all. I just pick up the bits and pieces that other independent researchers pick up in order to contest it or show that it's lies, right? I don't go direct to the source, and I certainly don't hang around people who, you know, who are on the teat of the mainstream media, so to speak, you know, who are imbibing that narrative 24/7 and believing in it, specifically that Trump is, you know, the second coming of Adolf Hitler kind of narrative. And so that, I mean that, I can just see how destabilizing, because for me even to hear about it, like I watched this Archon guy, I can't remember his name, but anyway, he does these videos. You've probably seen them. He's quite popular, and he was just talking about the people's reactions to Trump in order to mock them and scorn them. And I found even that upsetting, just because of what he was informing me, and that was even presented by somebody who, to a large extent, was expressing the indignation I would feel for me. So that was a massive buffer, right? When you've got it in the context of, right? But if you're just taking it, if you're being exposed to it constantly without irony and without awareness, it seems as though that, yeah, I mean that, I can only imagine just how difficult it would be to be constantly swimming against that current.
Yeah, and I think to my, I mean, I definitely over engaged in the media directly before the election. As I say, I got sucked in. I got into my pre, American studies student zone with that and thought I could handle it in a weird way. It's like a drug, right? You think you thought I could handle it, and I couldn't handle it. And so once it was over, literally maybe an hour into election night, I was like, I remember just thinking to myself, no more, not doing it. And just like it felt almost symbolically turning the television off and being like, no, this isn't ha I'm not going to engage with this. This is not what I'm going to do. It felt quite. It was such a weird feeling at the time, but yeah, it was destabilizing is a good word for it. And there's been a couple of times in the last couple of weeks where I knew that I didn't want to experience outrage consistently, and I'm not even entirely sure if you can genuinely experience outrage consistently without it becoming a performance, right? How can you be continuously outraged? So I knew that, but I've had a couple of times where I felt really like, okay, so I'm living in this world now where I leave the house with my dog so my dog can go to the bathroom and I bump into somebody that I vaguely know, and immediately they launch into their personal diatribe on Trump and post-Trump America. And they're telling me how to behave, and they're telling me what to do, and they're telling me that this is how to cope, like I need to cope. And I'm just sat there, and they're saying things like, well, I'm really concerned he's going to take us to war. And I have enough courage to be able to say, we're already at war, not sure. And they look at me like I'm completely bonkers. And I realize, like, oh, okay, so having my own spontaneous reaction to that, like what I actually think when you say something is not okay anymore. And as I say, losing like an old friend and then feeling on the precipice with a couple of other people obviously makes you feel like, well, how much do I have to step back? Because of course, like you think, well, I could just be the same. I could just accept this narrative. I know it well enough. I know it well enough to do it. I could do it. Would it be easy? Would it feel good? Maybe for a little while. But then at some point, I'm going to not be able to keep shut up about it. I'm not going to be able to. It's not comfortable for me too. So it's, I don't know, it's hard. And at the same time, doing that, I have to acknowledge, I'm like, well, you have a compulsion to do that. Why? What's going to come from it? Why not just let people go with what they're doing?
Yeah, and compulsion to do what?
To, I think, disagree,
Okay,
maybe,
yeah.
or
So, but that, I mean, I was going to come back to that. So, and that makes sense in the context that you've described, because it's like I was saying about swimming against the current. Like, if there isn't, if it isn't possible to take a neutral position, I mean, maybe it is possible, but it's really, really hard. I mean, the more virulent people are, the more strong the current is, the more difficult it is just to float along. Like, at a certain point, you have to actually start kicking against the current in order to not get pulled along by it, it seems to me. So then, if people are constantly battering you with these more than opinions, they're imperatives, really,
Yes.
and you don't disagree with them actively, there's going to be an assumption that you agree with them, I suppose. Although I guess it's kind of goes both ways, because if you don't agree virulently enough, there's going to be a suspicion that you disagree too, right? So in a way, you can't win. Like, you can't
No.
really be neutral anyway. So then the tendency is to dig one's heels in and be more disagreeable, I
Yeah, and I
think.
think you saying that because that immediately makes me think of how many times my friends have shared with me. I don't even remember who said it, but there's a quote that's like, "If you're silent, if you're silent, then you're on the side of the oppressor." I think there's a store down the road from here that even sells t-shirts with that statement on. And so, then the funny thing is you just said, "Well, if you're silent, then your friends are going to think that you don't agree with them or that you agree with them, right?" Yeah, and it's I don't know whether, but yeah, it does feel like that. It feels like, well, if I don't put my heel in the sand, then I'll be pushed along, and like that will be that. And I don't want to go there because there looks really not good. It looks really not fun, not a fun place to be in. Not to say where I am feels particularly fun, but I definitely don't want to be
Well,
where that
I
is.
think we're touching on the whole thing of social contagion, which potentially leads into mimetic violence, and what Girard writes about in terms of, it's almost impossible not to get swept along by it when a community is in extreme instability, and the binary opposition kicks in, and you have to join one side or the other. And in order to be on one side, you have to imitate the behaviors and keep pace with the outrage that leads to mimetic violence. It escalates into violence. So, and yeah, as you say, you don't want to participate in that, clearly. So what does it leave? Like, if you're part of a community that is being swept up into mimetic violence, and you know that if you don't join in, the violence will be directed at you sooner or later, because that's the nature of it. Scapegoating is part of the mimetic violence thing.
Yes.
It's a very intense situation to state the obvious. I'm trying to find the. Not find the silver lining, because I think clouds themselves are good. I mean, a thundercloud is good. You don't have to see the sun behind it. It's, something's breaking. But, like, what's the opportunity in that for you as an individual who doesn't want any of this to have a bearing on who you are? To come back to that phrase, right? This whole thing about we want to discover who and what we are without having to refer to external stuff, or superficial stuff, or just find out who we are. Well, there is, it seems as though this can only happen in a group in situation in some way. Sort of, it's not really paradoxical, but it's, I mean, the trope is of going off into the mountains and meditating and finding your inner core and connecting to it. But then the joke, the punchline is that guy who or girl who finds their core goes back to the marketplace, bumps into somebody, and gets in a fist fight, because they can't handle, they can't keep their center when they're back in the throng.
No, and you
So
have to.
yeah, you have to find your center in the throng. to some extent at least. I mean, it's not enough to go away and find it and then come back to the throng. You've got to be coming in and out of the herd, I think.
Mm.
And that is an individuation process. So that, I mean, I'm just wondering out loud, of course, if, like, because I have the negative identity thing, well, everybody does, but I mean, I'm aware of it myself, how I want to disagree with people I feel more, whatever, secure or more confident if I'm disagreeing.
Yes.
Generally. And so that can be a problem, that can be as a complex of sorts. But then the desire to join the group is a problem too. Like that need to belong and be accepted, I recognize, is also an issue.
Yes, I think that's right. And it's interesting because I was speaking to someone just about the situation with losing friends and feeling like I'm going to be losing more friends in the near future, and not being certain what to do about that or if I should really be doing anything about that. And she said to me, well, it's interesting how some people will always value their self-image and the image they present to others over connection to other people. So if connection to you or acknowledgement of you or engaging with what you're saying threatens their image,
mm-hmm.
then they will discard you first.
Mm-hmm.
And they won't, because it doesn't allow them to say, well, this, I want to present myself as this person and your presence here is a problem.
Right.
Which is, you know, it's something that I then, you know, when somebody says that about, then I always think, well, do I do that? You know, you always think, well, is that something that I do? And I think I disagree with a lot of people who I'm close with about a lot of different things, but, and I've maybe been sullen about it at times, but I still feel like I wouldn't get rid of them, right? I maybe that's because I feel like I have strong enough convictions that I don't need to do that. Or if I just don't, why would I want to do that? Like what would be the purpose of it? But, and I don't know. The idea of, I think it's partly also that you think you do need to get on in the crowd, like you say, and like sometimes having that contrition isn't always such a bad thing.
Flexibility, humility.
Yes. And obviously not feeling dogmatic, maybe, about certain things over just other human connection. But I just got this, it felt like also this sort of sense of it, and it sounds like a really silly analogy, but it's like, you know, like the zombie situation where you're like, which friend is going to turn next, right? Like he's going to turn next. And you're like, well, you don't know they're going to turn until they turn, right? You don't know.
If they've been bitten, you know, right? You've got to chop the head off before they turn.
But they're not always in your sight, so they may have been bitten when you didn't notice.
Yeah.
And it's this sort of feeling of like that time after the election where everybody was in that sort of freaking out stage, that there was almost this like in that, in the Men in Black movies with Will Smith, or the mythology of Men in Black, where they just wipe your memory and then you start again.
Yeah.
And it's like, feels a little bit like that too. And you're like, well, am I the only one that remembers all the shit things that happened before? Mm. You know, it feels very like being in a where everybody around you seems to be reacting like this is the first experience of everything that they're experiencing.
Yeah, I think that's very acute, and I think that's very much the purpose of this kind of theater, this triggering strategy, whatever it is, to get people into panic mode, not only in it, but actually believing in it and thinking that this is an appropriate thing to panic, as we said, to be outraged, to have strong emotional reactions, and not to be thinking clearly. They wouldn't take it that far because they're not thinking clearly enough to recognize that panicking and being outraged means you're not thinking clearly, right? But that is that, and that is, of course, serves the interests of those groups and individuals who are interested in herding society and keeping us polarized and all the rest of it. Now, unfortunately, generally that interpretation of society is confined to the lunatic fringe even now. And it's a weird thing happening now because Alex Jones is now kind of mainstream, so he's still lunatic. So it's the lunatic mainstream now, right?
Yeah, it's true.
But it's still considered lunatic, and to some extent, rightly. Like, it's not these kind of methods and strategies for social control aren't being represented in a way that is cogent enough to lead people to reason. But it was occurring to me before when you were talking that it seems absolutely essential, at least short of some kind of psychological wholeness, which is even harder to come by, if people are going to see Trump for what he is or the situation for what it is, they need deep politics awareness. They need to be able to put what's happening now into the context of history, you know, of social engineering, of deep politics, and so on. And, you know, but when they're not doing that, they're actually, well, yeah, they're watching a piece of theatre and actually identifying so strongly that they forget and getting swept away by the emotions that theatre is designed to provoke in us. And so then they're becoming, it's rabble-rousing, really. They're becoming, it's like a kind of theatre in which the fourth wall is designed to collapse and the audience will become hysterical and riot because they get so swept away by, I mean, it did happen, I think, didn't it, sometimes?
I think you're right.
The audience members would kill the actor who played Iago or what have you if it was too effective or if they were just too susceptible to being triggered.
I think being swept away, that means I'm not suggesting, you know, there's a kind of idea of helplessness going on here as well that I think, you know, is a lot of people are taking on because it's useful to seem to be sort of, oh, I'm helpless in this, but they're being blocked from seeing it in a context that is necessary to really kind of get what's going on, I suppose. You know, that obviously all this rhetoric around, like, he is the worst president ever, he's the least qualified president, he's the least popular president, all that rhetoric is very much about making him seem unique and special and separate, and this being a unique, special, separate experience, as well as that the whole idea of, like, well, you know, how are you reacting? Like, reaction policing. Like, not only are you panicking or you're not panicking, but also are you joining the #resistance, right? Mm-hmm. Which is so disturbing to me. And or are you, you know, are you part of this group or are you part of that group? Which is not a new thing, right? But it's because of the stakes have been created to be heightened in a way that's false, in a sense, that everybody feels like, oh, well, this is a new situation. Everybody's going to be judged on how they respond to this situation. Doesn't matter what you've done before. Doesn't matter what's gone before. This is it. This is a decider.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the stakes are made to feel very high there. Like you said, saying, like, he's Hitler and you know, this is what happened then and this is what happened now, and let's compare the two. And you know, and I think, and then the other side of what you said was interesting about Alex Jones and the conspiracy, because I feel like obviously what's happened is you had, and you talked about this, you've talked about this before, and I, you know, is how the conspiracy world has become mainstream and people have, it's become like a subset or something. But then at the same time, there's been a little bit out there recently about this idea, oh, there's these, like the idea of conspiracy theory being an activity, or researching in the conspiracy world is activity that's only done by people on the right wing or the far right, yeah, they call them now. And now there's this phrase called the blue detectives, which they're calling people who they see as, who see themselves as Democrat or liberal, who are taking up this sort of conspiracy style, I guess, rather than, I don't know if even if you would think of it, but it's a style. So there is all, you know, these people out there who are almost co-opting the methodology or the language, and certainly using the term conspiracy a lot, to make connections that you're like, well, okay, some of that makes sense maybe, but then some of it really feels like a red herring, like the connection between Trump and Russia, and you know, those sort of things that seem, on at least on face value, to be so obviously
bogus.
Yes,
but
exactly.
But that's the one that most people are buying into, though. That one's not even considered a conspiracy theory, is it?
Well, I think that's interesting, because I think there was a point at which people who were talking about it were being called conspiracy theorists, but because their politics was against Trump, then that was okay. It was like, well, they're just doing investigative reporting, right? They're just doing the job that the media isn't doing. Or they're doing the job in their part-time as people who are in the media. So, but you know, it's funny because yes, everybody accepts that, including the lady I bumped into on the street when I took my dog out the other day, accepts that as the narrative. They're like, well, this is what's happening. I'm like, oh, okay. And you thought, you know, how many times, you know, you've decided that's your conspiracy and you agree with that. But
I think it's, isn't it to do with, because of course it came via the CIA, and just 5 years ago these same people would distrust it because it came from the CIA, and now they're so desperate that they're seeing that as legitimizing or something.
Right, you know? Isn't that the point, though? I've said this a couple of times. I feel like, you know, we get Trump. I don't know how long we're going to get him for. Maybe the full 4 years. I don't know. All I know is what comes after him is probably going to be worse, and it's going to be a Democrat, and they're going to be able to say whatever and do whatever they want because everybody's going to be so grateful that it's not Trump, right? I mean, we could have anybody at this point, anybody doing anything at this point, and people would be like, oh, thank God, it's not Donald Trump.
Which is just bizarre. I mean, what is that? Like,
yeah,
it seems like it's a, I guess it's infantile in the deep sense. Like, it's because there's a visceral terror and hatred of Trump. And this is what I was going to say about the Russian narrative. People buy it because they want something that's big enough to account for their outrage. They don't want to feel that it's just personal dislike, or even just that they disagree with his policies. To know that, you know, the only other superpower is actually going to, you know, take over democracy, kind of thing. That's big enough.
Right? That's so interesting. Yeah, I think you're right. You're right on that. And new people want that narrative because then they can say, well, I couldn't have done anything, or you know, I think there was, like I said, like this period of, like, I think is the right phrase, learned helplessness, and people were presenting a lot of that, and then yes, maybe that was how they were like, well, how do I get myself back upright again? This is how I do it. I attach myself to this huge narrative of, like, global conspiracy.
Which, of course, was one of Trump's tickets in, was that he was, to some extent, compared to other contenders, was acknowledging the global conspiracy, you know, the cryptocracy, and was claiming that he was going to do something about it.
Yes, and I think there's still people who support him who believe that. I mean, going on, what was he on the other day? Fox News or something, and they said, oh, they were talking about Russia, and he was like, oh, do you think America hasn't killed enough people or something like that? You know, and people were like, shocked.
Yeah.
Like a president saying that America is dangerous,
right.
America kills people. Like, that's to them, that's like, how, you know, what do I do with that? That has to be outrageous, right? It can't be considered, it can't be thought through. But then there was a faction of people, I'm sure, who were like, yes, this is our man.
Well, I mean, the left would have dreamed of having a president who would say something like that.
I know, right? I did a number on us, for sure. That's exactly, which is why, like, it's so impossible to how do you even start that conversation? But yeah, I think I think, you know, as you say, he was built up to be that, and he sort of took it on himself, and Cult, obviously he got Alex Jones in there, and he sort of took it on himself, and you know, he knew that he was using that to his benefit, perhaps. I don't know. I don't, you know, you don't know how. The thing is, you always have to wonder how much can be planned for, right?
Yeah, I was just wondering about exactly that, and I was thinking that doesn't it have to do with the awareness of charismatic leaders and how charisma is the thing that moves masses, and so that each given leader that's chosen, let's see, we had Clinton, then we had W, then we had Obama, and now we had this one, that they have a different kind of charisma. Like, they all have charisma. They wouldn't be presidents if they didn't.
Mm.
It's not always obvious. It was mm-hmm. obvious with Obama, not to me, but to lots of people. I thought Clinton was obviously charismatic. I used to like watching Clinton. I couldn't say why, just something about him was kind of mesmerizing. W, a little bit, just his goofiness, you know, his stupidity was kind of charismatic. Reagan, certainly charismatic. Trump, I haven't actually watched him, I don't know, but I can imagine he does. So, and charisma is to do with the false ceremony masters. That's a charisma is one of the shamanic capacities, along with weather control, and I forget. There's four of them. They're quite interesting because they're generally considered impossible by us, but charisma is one that we recognise is real, even though we can't explain it. Unless you're going to go into MK Ultra and stuff, which I would, right? Like, how do they create charisma? I think they do. But in terms of the average person, no, we just say that person has charisma and this one doesn't. And it's, you know, it's a very visceral, subjective thing. And I think that relates to how it's to do with affect and to do with a sort of, a child, a more childish part of us or a regressed part.
Mm.
That simply responds to at that very sort of deep emotional and affective level to what it needs or what it wants from a parent figure.
Mm.
And then it will bond to that figure in some way and be moved by it. But it could work negatively as well. It could be a negative bonding happening also.
Mm. Yeah, and I think the parent idea of the election and parents came up quite a bit during that time, and people could see it almost in themselves. And I think, you know, they would talk about, well, Donald Trump's the dad and Hillary Clinton's the mom. And there was this joke I remember going around where it was like, and we all just want to go and live with granddad, who's Bernie Sanders, right?
Mm.
And get rid of both of them. Which, you know, I think some people saw that and were joking about it. And the fact that they were joking about it shows something anyway, doesn't it? That they had to joke about it that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. mean, and talking about charisma, and you're talking about celebrity as well, which made me think of like what we were talking about, the mourning celebrity deaths over the 2016, and how that narrative was like, oh, 2016 is killing all these wonderful celebrities, and we have to move on from that. And you have to think, well, like what was that about? Like it was about almost bolstering and cementing, and the celebrity worship was in having them, not they did, you know, they died, right? But talking about it in the way that it was talked about. And then who do we get as a president? As a celebrity, right? There's something going on there, I feel like, something underneath going on there that perhaps, you know, as well, it's like, I don't think it was just people who voted for Donald Trump who were pulled in by him in the beginning, because, you know, if you probably tracked it, it was people who had aligned themselves as liberal or Democrat who probably were talking about him more in the early days, right? He was getting more of their attention for being whatever they wanted him to be, a joke or a clown or whatever they thought he was, or said they thought he was, but there was something going on there that meant that they were definitely looking at him that whole time. And so if you think of like the way that a lot of the political commentators, especially like the comedians, you know, out there that get, you know, that a lot of people get most of their political or like news from, like Bill Maher and Daily Show and, you know, Jon Stewart and all those shows, right? And that he was sort of their part. He was intensely got their attention for months and months and months. And the fact they were joking about him is like, well, yeah, but no, he still had some kind of hold on them.
My celebrity obsession with Clint Eastwood, it took me until I was 40 or so, or older actually, 45 or something, when I was writing Seen and Not Seen. Maybe I'd seen the clues before, but it was when I first actually wrote it down. But that he, Clint Eastwood, I think it was when I saw a picture of my father when he was young, and although I'd seen pictures of him when he was young before, this was a particularly striking one. I was on his shoulders, he was carrying me, I was about 5, and I have a picture, I use it on one of my laptops as the avatar, because it's a very rare moment. Like, I don't remember that moment, and I don't remember any moments with my father being fatherly in that way. I just remember him kind of shunning me and being completely just uninterested in me. But what struck me about the photo beside that was he was smiling with his big broad smile and his brown hair. He still had all of it. He looked like Clint Eastwood a little bit. I mean, kind of a lot, but just it was just certain features that were very clearly, oh, that's like Clint's smile, that's like Clint's hair. And so that all the parts together didn't really look like Clint, but certain parts were very clearly, and he was 6'4", so same height as Clint. So the penny dropped anyway, and I said, okay, so it wasn't just about Clint being cool or Clint being tough, or Clint's actual persona was very, very different from my father's, actually. Mm. But there was something physical there. And that kind of clued me to look at other factors in terms of why Clint Eastwood was appealing to me as a personality, why I would want a father like that, like a really strong, silent, tough, vengeful kind of father, was because I was being bullied and it was, you know, and so on. There were reasons, right? So I was just wondering, you know, how much, like, because this I'd looked into, I started uncovering stuff when I was doing Occult Yorkshire with John Balsby and Tavistock and whatnot, and the whole attachment theory, when they were discovering about attachment theory and how important it was, like an infant that doesn't have a healthy attachment to its mother, and which also depends on a healthy attachment to the father, right? Because the father is there to help dissolve the attachment from the mother so it doesn't stay too long, and so on. So you have to have a healthy relationship with both parents.
Mm-hmm.
To develop a healthy ego, let's say, in the positive sense, a healthy sense of self. So they were discovering all of this with Tavistock and Balsby and whatnot. But then congruent with that, or at least quite soon after that, was MKUltra and the mind control through ritual abuse and all of that stuff. And one of the premises of that is you've got to sabotage the child's bonding to its mother. That's kind of the foundation of creating a fragmented identity that can then be programmed and controlled.
Right.
So then I'm really extrapolating all this just as a sort of working hypothesis on the fly.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of celebrities, like knowing the extent to which as children we have our attachment, our parental bonds are sabotaged, we're going to be looking for that we're going to be looking for the thing that we didn't have. We're going to be looking for parental figures. We're going to be transferring constantly onto other figures. And that would make us incredibly susceptible to manipulation, particularly if there was a certain sense of what kind of figures, of how to create the figures that would correspond with our wounds, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I don't know how to go further from that, except so far as, of course, if some of these celebrities are actually abusers, like somebody has suggested. I mean, some of the testimonies do say that presidents and high-power celebrities are involved in the abuse. So clearly that would be a very overt way that people would be being triggered, because they would, you know, Stockholm Syndrome, they would be attaching to these celebrities if they'd literally been abused by them. But there could also be a much more complex mechanism there, which in terms of if celebrity or people who put forward as celebrities have themselves been controlled, mind controlled, abused, traumatized in such a way that they develop a persona and a charisma that intersects directly with the collective's wounds, you know, with the more passive individuals' need to be guided, to have a guide or a caregiver, an imaginary one, of course. I mean, it's all, I mean, we can see that it's basically unhealthy insofar as it's unreal. Like if like Clint Eastwood didn't help me, you know, it didn't even give me a good role model. So right. So we can see that. But how much deeper might it be than that in terms of, I'm sort of trying to bring it around to where we started now in terms of the Hollywood Illuminati and the possibility that there is a kind of a super culture that is underneath and on top of the culture that most of us move in, which is designed to trigger us in specific ways so that we are constantly reacting to it.
Yeah, it's funny. It's interesting. That's the thought that you've had just at the end there, that reacting to it and being triggered to react to it. Because I remember earlier this month, I was reading about like where movies and actors and movie directors will go next. Like, what's the next Hollywood frontier to make movies? And it was all about how they would make movies that had implicit or explicit interactivity. So you would have a movie that through facial recognition technology would respond to how you reacted to it.
Right.
So if your attention was in a certain direction for a certain character or revulsion or enjoyment, like the narrative would change. Based on how you responded to it. And it was really interesting actually, because they were talking about like this, whether like the original idea was this idea of basically of making what would be like choose your own adventure movies, which is just like, well, you could have a multiple different endings or multiple angles on the same story, and everybody could choose to watch a different film. And you think, well, yeah, obviously they're probably going to end up doing that. But then there was this subset of it that was like, well, what if it was implicit interactivity, where like you didn't say I want to follow this narrative, but it was reading you and responding to you. And there was one bit that was just fascinating, which was like talking about you saying that Clint Eastwood looked like your father, vice versa. This idea that they would take how you looked, the person watching the film, and impose that onto the characters so you would have more empathy for them,
right?
Which is just, can you think? I mean,
wow. Yeah. Well, that's kind of a literalization is what I was groping my way towards there, I think. And it's reminded me of something else, which is that I haven't noticed it recently, I used to see all kinds of different actors and think, that looks like my brother.
Mm.
Diverse as... I don't know, Dirk Bogart, Robert Downey Jr. I can't even remember anymore. There were just so many, and I would really see it. You know, when you see a resemblance, and maybe you say it to someone else, and they're just, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. But you feel like you can really see it. It's not just a sort of, the nose is a bit similar, but you can see the person's face kind of inside this movie star's face. That was the experience I have, anyway. And it can only be because of the imprinting, right? Because my brother was such a profound psychic influence on me that I'm imprinted with his face. So naturally I superimpose it. Any face that slightly, close enough resembles the objective features, I will then unconsciously superimpose the face in my own mind or my own psyche onto that external face. And then, of course, I'll be interacting with an imago. I'll be interacting with, these projections of my own psyche.
And I think on the opposite end of that, if there were actors or film stars that were really important in your childhood, then you see their face. Not for me, it's not necessarily their face, but like their mannerisms and their facial expressions in other people.
Right.
And like that, often I'll meet somebody for the first time, and I won't be able to shake the way that I feel that they are like that person in the way they react. And of course, you don't, it's hard. You always just think, well, there are only so many ways a person can be, right? That's that's what you assume. This is only a finite way that people can be. But yeah, no, that's always a weird one, because then I can't ever get rid of the thought of it.
Well, do you think that actors develop a technique? And I'm wondering, how far reaching this is, because I have a feeling I did podcast about this a long time ago, about how acting, you know, Stanislavski and the method acting, how in so many different ways it overlaps with mind control and the techniques of mind control. It's kind of an auto mind control method acting. But anyway, I wasn't even going there. Where I was going was that, you know, to what extent is acting a continuation of an ancient art of illusion casting, really, by which a really good actor, just like a really good magician or a really good hypnotist or a really good therapist or a really good predator, creates a sort of blank slate onto which people will project stuff. You know, they learn a way of moving and of talking and of facial expression that somehow, it's something quite mysterious, and probably relates to charisma, but somehow it takes our projections and it gives life to them.
Right, and that's what we call a good actor.
Yeah. Yeah, or not, or perhaps not, like Clint Eastwood. I mean, no one really thought he was a good actor, but he certainly, he knew how to move. He had presence. So it may be both, but it could be either or, like presence and or acting technique.
A virtual version of it, like you said, like what point are we going to get to where they just amalgamate and distill what that is and just make it into something that is, you know, that they don't have to pay every time.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's what you're touching on with these interactive things.
Yeah.
And I think it's like the way that a media develops, it's always striving to become what it is, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So that it starts very primitive, but then they develop more and more means to achieve the desired end. And people become more and more down with the program, so to speak. They're being engineered to sort of bring to the table their own expectations, and then they'll do half the work for that media. The final result is to create this virtual world in which a person can get completely lost and forget they exist and never come out again. Well, I mean, wasn't that really the goal of the kinetoscope in the first place, really? It's just that they couldn't do it, make it interesting for more than a few seconds to begin with. But eventually it becomes potentially all immersive.
Right. Yeah, because you have the convergence with virtual reality too, right? So,
yeah, with the technology, but also it's collective desire is increasing. Like back in the early days, it's a very interesting topic, isn't it? Because to what extent is the supply creating the demand? Like dissociation is a survival tool that we have when things are unbearable, but if dissociation becomes developed to the point that we can do it whenever we want, the more we dissociate, the more conditions will worsen in reality, the more we'll need to dissociate.
Right.
Do you see what I mean?
So, I do, yeah.
So I think there's something that might be a way to kind of look at what we're seeing now playing out in terms of this liminality and this insanity and the collective hysteria as kind of escalating to the point that people are gratefully entering into these fake reality tunnels that are indistinguishable from the crisis that they're trying to escape from. I don't know if that even makes any sense. I'm just trying to get my mind around it.
Right, that they're building, like, they're not really engaging with what is actually happening. This is interesting because my husband got quite swept into it too and got quite stressed by it. And I had to sort of have this moment with him where I was like, look, where are you right now? You're sat here. We're fine. In fact, for all intents and purposes, like, practically speaking, we're better than we've ever been, right? Mm. In terms of being comfortable and okay and safe, right?
Mm.
So that's your reality.
Mm.
That's your reality. The reality is what you have right now here. And he was like, yeah, yeah, I guess so. And I was like, what you're seeing on the internet is not how you are experiencing life today. Mm. Like, this is not your experience of life. So, and the same for me, I kind of was told, obviously, like, whenever you say anything to anybody, you're kind of saying it to yourself, right?
Sure.
So I feel like, you know, yeah, I can see that as you are disassociating when you enter into these fake worlds or narratives or whatever it is, because it's not even oftentimes now engaging with what's actually happening.
Yeah.
It's engaging with the presentation. It's once removed, it's engaging with the presentation of what's happening.
Yeah.
Like, I don't think people are even going to look necessarily for what's happening, because to do that, where they would have to directly, like you said, oh, I haven't watched Trump, right?
Mm.
I think a lot of people literally stopped watching him, right? Because they couldn't. And I have, I don't, I, when I, if I have the TV on, or if I see, if I have something on the computer, any, I just mute it.
Right.
And so how many people are doing that? I think a lot, which means really all these people who are really into that, like, hysteria, to me, must own, seems like they must only really be reacting to the reaction.
Yeah, yeah. Which, right? Could be fabricated entirely. You see what I mean? I mean, people, yeah, aren't checking the actual facts or statements or the rest of it. They're that much more susceptible to believing the spin.
Right. And I think there's a lot of people who aren't. And I mean, I don't even know, because I remember when I was watching him and listening to him, and I would listen to his, you know, we were talking about the charisma before, and I was always trying to figure out what it was about the way he spoke. It wasn't what he said.
Mm.
But it was the way he spoke,
yeah,
I found very interesting. And I'd be like, right, I can't, like, it would do something to my mind listening to him. And it wasn't what he was saying, but it was the way he said it that really, and, you know, everybody always says that, right, about, like, you know, very charismatic people, it's the way they say something.
Yeah.
But the way he was saying things was sort of like, it felt very discombobulating and disjointed and almost nonsensical, but it felt like it was doing that with a purpose.
Right.
It didn't feel like he was doing that because he's just an idiot, right? Or that he doesn't know how to speak, or that he doesn't understand what he's talking about, which is what we're told, right? Is that he's just stupid.
Yeah.
It was that he was doing something, and I just couldn't, I couldn't guess what it was. I didn't know what it was, but I knew he was doing something.
Huh. Oh, interesting.
And now I just mute him, which I think is, I'm not the only person doing that. And if you're not, and, you know, if you're muting him and you're just, all you're seeing is what people are telling, the media is telling you. And then we have this whole amazing thing with the media, of course, talking about fake worlds, where, you know, they obviously felt like, oh, well, we've had the highest ratings ever for this election, right? More people reading websites, watching the news. And then people stop. And so what did they do? They manufactured a reason for people to continue consuming that media, which was Trump is attacking the media. Trump hates journalists. There's all this fake news out there, so you better get your subscription to the New York Times. And, you know, I often sat and thought, well, who's benefited more from this than anybody? Well, you know, the fact that more people are watching Saturday Night Live than ever, and more people are buying the New York Times than ever, more people are buying the Washington Post than ever. And what a great position to be in,
mm-hmm,
for them, right? You know, the dying industry, as far as we were told, and now it's...
Right.
We can continue that beyond the point of the election cycle. And, you know, these people are only sustained by the election cycle.
You know the drill, that's the end of the first part. Next part, next Wednesday. And for the date lovers among you, that's the 15th of March 2017, that's where we are, year zero, apparently, according to Julian Assange or somebody. There's a new forum I'm participating at. It's alteredminds.co.uk. I didn't create the forum, but I did encourage its coming into being with a fellow ex-rigorous intuition, Ite, and it's shaping up into a sort of blend of disgruntled RI members and horticulture Lemurist listener readers, and I'm sure other people too will find their way there, but it seems to be moving along quite nicely, so if you want to participate there, then once again, that's alteredminds.co.uk. Next few podcasts will be with Francis Hutchins, Keith Gordon, William Ramsey, David Livingston, and a blog that I'm a podcast that I'm very well, I'm going to keep mum about, but I think it's going to be quite explosive. That will be in the next few weeks. Do keep supporting this enterprise, if only by listening, commenting, telling your buddies about it. If you want to donate, there's the means in the widget bar at horticulture.com where you listen to this podcast. Maybe make a one-time donation or regular monthly ones. Or you can buy the book Seen and Not Seen. This is the Horsley signing off one more time for the Limitless.